bear with us as we get the live feed going. We are recording, everybody. Good evening, everyone. We're getting started. I ask we all rise for the Pledge of the Flag.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mr. Miller, please call the roll.
Ms. Callahan.
Present.
Ms. Francis Smith.
Present.
Ms. Quiatek.
Present.
Ms. Laird.
Present.
Ms. Leon.
Present.
Ms. Wilhelm.
Present.
And Mr. Colon.
Present. Thank you. Approval of minutes for our October 7, 2025 council meeting. Any comments on minutes? Minutes stand approved. Moving on to public comment. As is custom, our first public comment is for any subject not being voted on this evening. I will remind everyone we have a 5-minute time limit. We do have 6 people signed up, so I'll start with our list of those who signed up in advance, starting with Harry Faber.
If you'd like to.
I just ask you to do your best speaking to the microphone.
Hello, Harry Faber. This past weekend was historic for many reasons. On the one hand, tens of millions of Americans organized and demonstrated all across the country, thousands in the Lehigh Valley. Given the circumstances and opportunity costs of such a demonstration, it is safe to say Americans are fed up with the status quo. It is a known fact that our tax dollars and resources are not being spent and invested in the sustainable well-being of the working class. But yet, on the other hand, the No Kings rallies were a historical failure in effecting change. Millions were told to take this energy to the ballot box. Quote, all we can do is vote, end quote. More specifically, vote for the Democrats. I stand on this side today because I recognize what our predecessors recognized over 100 years ago, that the duopoly represents two sides of the same coin, that coin being capital and capital accumulation. Eugene Debs gave his famous speech in 1912, we have two parties but one problem. Slaves did not vote themselves out of slavery. The subjects of colonialism did not vote away the colonizers. Hitler was not defeated in the ballot box. How foolish we must be to think now is any different. We must be able to vote in elections, or we might be able to vote in elections, but my experience attending these council meetings has confirmed my understanding that what we have now is not democracy. I don't even like the term bourgeois democracy. We live under the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, dictatorship of capital, and dictatorship of growth. Thankfully for the working class, we have a way out. There is an alternative. The working class has organized and overthrown the grip of dictatorship in the past. We can do it again. We cannot let this revolutionary moment burn out. To quote Climate-Leninism and Revolutionary Transition by Kai Heron and Jody Dean, quote, the challenge of transition thus pushes us toward that form of political organization that endures, scales, supports a collective consciousness, and enables coordinated action. Lenin's theory and practice point to such a form, the party. When a strong party base is established and a period of political upheaval is underway, growth can be rapid and dramatic. The Bolsheviks grew 10 times in size between February and September of 1917, from 20,000 to 200,000 members. I've seen this with my own eyes in Lehigh Valley DSA. I would encourage anyone who recognizes the form of fascism we are up against today and has the time, energy, and or resources to join us and get in contact. Our next general meeting is November 17th, 6:30 p.m. at the Church of Nativity. You can be reached at lehighvalleydsa.org. and on email at dsalehigh@gmail.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Faber. Our next speaker is Reverend Bruce Stevenson.
Remember me?
Welcome back.
You don't? After 40 years as a parish pastor, I've come to the conclusion that people are more apt to complain than they are to praise. I have a hunch that's been your experience on council. I am not here to complain tonight. I am here to praise. I came to this council twice before tonight asking that a safety line be painted on Pennsylvania Avenue where I live because of all the cars that had been hit on the side of the road. And I was delighted one morning as I was going off to work to see that there were some public servers or service folks who were measuring the side of the road. And I ran up to them and I said, "Are you going to paint the line?" And they said, "Yes, it'll be there by the end of the week." And lo and behold, I got my line. Thank you. Thank you for hearing us. Thank you for listening to us. And thank you for the line. My neighbors and I have noticed a decrease in speed. We've noticed that cars are not hugging the curb as they once did. Let's just hope it continues that way. So I believe that what you did made a difference for us, and I thank you. And if it's okay, if it's allowed to do so, I would like to approach you and shake your hand out of gratitude.
Feel free to.
Okay, well, I didn't know how close I was allowed to get to.
Works department deserves the majority of all the credit.
You shook the right hand in Mr. Allen.
Okay. I'm going to shake it again. I'll shake it for another 2 minutes.
That would be a first. I love it though.
Thank you, Reverend. Our next speaker is Mirza Figueroa. And I'll just reiterate again, Mr. Alcall, our public works director, none of us were painting any streets. It's the public works crews that goes out and handles our potholes, our snow removal, our street painting. So they, not only Mr. Alcall, his department, down to the crew that was out there, deserves all the credit.
Definitely. I'm just kind of piggybacked by Mr. Bruce. I'm more than ecstatic. So happy. We feel a lot better, and then even we feel more safe in a way that we could actually park in front of the house without thinking that somebody's going to hit us, or even at night, actually, because obviously the lights hit it and it kind of glows. So we noticed a huge difference. So I just want to say thank you. And I appreciate for everything that you guys do. And I just, like I said, the first time that I was here a couple years ago, I love Bethlehem and I want to still stay here for as long as I can. So thank you so much. Just appreciate everything.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Randy Rice.
Good evening. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. This is my first time here. I've worked as a teacher and lived in Bethlehem for the last 5 years after growing up in the surrounding counties. I'm a retired teacher, professor of 30 years. I've also worked in area hospitals and I'm a graduate of Penn State and our Keating universities. I love the state and I love the city. I still have many friends, family, and colleagues in this area. All of us have the same concerns about the future here. Every time I cross the Mincy Trail Bridge, I'm reminded of how lucky we are to have the old steel mills and stacks to remind us of how very important
this city was in a very important time in our country, and they're just a few examples. In the past, the city has become a shining example of the blending of different cultures, ages, ethnicities, religions, political views, and socioeconomic groups. It's a testimony as to what can be achieved with hard work and cooperation. It's how our country has survived two world wars, an explosion of migration of 18 million people nationwide in the last few years, and drastic changes in the job skills needed in this new information age. This cooperation was built on tradition. In a successful model, the old teach the young. It has been demonstrated all over our country and globally. There is, however, a current imbalance in our city, like many cities. The elderly in Bethlehem make up a large proportion of citizens with healthcare dollars to spend. They already struggle with a shortage of affordable housing, and they suffer from the same transportation problems we all have. That's just one issue. They're leaving the city at an alarming rate to seek a better life. As the information age continues and evolves, we are seeing technology continue to replace unskilled jobs. This is a trend that will grow. Unskilled labor has been forced to adapt and take other jobs. Other skilled labor as well is in need of efficient, well-maintained roads and highways. This is a problem requiring careful planning for our roads and highways. Additionally, many of those with computer skills are working from homes, if they can. The intersection of Gep and Maple Avenues is a perfect example. There must be a way to divert traffic from this area of town every day, despite a crossing guard for the school children, a flashing light, signs, and paintings on the road. I see drivers speeding through this intersection. They will not stop, nor will they slow down to allow people to cross Gep. I myself was involved in a very bad car accident two blocks from my house in May, just sitting at a stop sign. The driver was driving double the speed limit. And as is the case with many younger drivers, they are six times more likely to cause accidents and be involved in DUIs. I see drivers speeding through these intersections on these back streets. They will not stop. Many are trying to find alternate ways to access US 22 and 78 as well. And they're using once quiet side streets like Maple Avenue, where young children play and neighbors walk their dogs. It has caused many accidents in my neighborhood and has made it especially difficult for the elderly just to get out and do their grocery shopping and get to their doctor's appointments. My neighbor across the street has had two cars total just in the last 2 months. Even on quieter Sundays, I have seen horrible accidents at this intersection due to a large number of young drivers who are texting and speeding. Anyone with significant driving experience knows that in a town like Bethlehem, even if you don't have a stop sign, you need to slow down at these intersections on these back roads. It's a known fact that cars park on both sides of the street in many neighborhoods, and visibility is poor for other drivers who are trying to cross. Other cities with these issues have already made changes. This isn't the only issue with this location. Many drivers beep and swear at each other, demonstrating other road rage as well, instead of just slowing down so that others can cross occasionally. Additionally, citizens living in this area have to deal with the deafening noise from motorcycles and trucks. It's an area already burdened with the noise from ambulances and police sirens, understandably. It disturbs the peace, wakes us in our sleep, and is forcing many homeowners to look for the quieter neighborhoods they used to have. I ask for your talent, attention, and innovative ideas to solve these problems in the short term as well as the long term. We have so much history and so many memories of our beautiful city that will be lost as the population changes when prosperity leaves. Thank you, will become like many other cities. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker signed up is Mike O'Hare.
Hello, Mike O'Hare, 632 4th Avenue, Bethlehem. Unlike the Reverend, I will do a little complaining, but not so much about City Council, but about the Bethlehem Co-op. And I wanted to talk about some of the situations that I see going on there. So we'll just start back in November of 2019. The city council voted to approve $105,000 in a community development block grant to the Bethlehem Co-op. Then in July 2021, the Bethlehem Co-op was awarded another $2.9 million in a federal grant, which was administered by the city as a pass-through, from my understanding. In September 2022, there was another $100,000 awarded to the co-op in a state grant. The co-op now reports that they are $1 million in debt. They were to open in 2022, and they have no idea when they're going to be opening. Three years later. No plans anytime soon. So in the third class city code, the way I read it, is city council has the obligation or the ability to have oversight over any department, office, agency of the city government. Seems to me like city council should be overseeing what was done with this public money. These were all public monies that were awarded to the co-op. And I really feel that we need an explanation of what's going on there. So city council, I believe, has the oversight power to do something about this and to make sure that the citizens are aware of what's happening with the co-op and where that money went. But the issue that I'm seeing here is that a lot of the folks in this room, city council, the mayor, others, were very strong proponents of the co-op. So is it wise to have some independent body look at it, control or whatever? I don't know. I'll leave that to your wisdom. But I do feel that we need to do something to, and I'm not trying to say that there was anything illegal or wrong done, but they obviously need some help. And I think maybe the city could provide that expertise that they need to get to where they need to be. Or is it something that's just not workable anymore? You're $1 million in debt, you have no plans to open the store. Is it time to look at a different use for that building? Maybe a warming shelter, maybe something else, I don't know. So that's what I wanted to bring up about the co-op. Is it recoverable? And I was thinking to myself, if this is an example of a government-run grocery store, we're all gonna starve. So. The other thing I wanted to talk about was the 540 Democrat Club. I'm reading a lot of reports in the newspaper every month, every other month, about a shooting, a stabbing that's going on in that area, in that club, or outside the club. And I know the city's on it. I know things are being done. But I'm asking for continued vigilance in that area because bad things are happening, and I'm afraid worse things could happen in that area. Thanks to the city for, you know, monitoring and doing what they can do there. But is there something else, some other remedy that could be exercised against that club? Lose their liquor license, do something like that? I don't know if that's the purview of the city or not. And then I do want to thank the Bethlehem Police Department and the Public Works. Agree with the Reverend about the great job that they do in keeping our city safe and livable. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. O'Hare. Our next speaker is Artie Kirtle. I'm sorry, is Mr. Kirtle here?
He's coming to this side. That way.
Hi, I'm Artie Kirtle, 813 Lawford Street in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Hope you're all doing well tonight. I'd like to say, I served my country. I got out in 1968, as most of my family served the country. It took me until 2015 to be able to talk right again. Now it's hard to shut me up. But the thing is, really, I'm still kind of getting your focus. I mean, after all these years. But, however, the thing is, I gave what I could to serve my country. Many of my friends gave their all. Many of my family gave their all. To go for a country that we're paying our taxes, have attorneys in Congress give raises to elected officials. when we're supposed to be a country in God we trust, one nation under God, but we do not tithe our 10%. If we did, we could have an organization that will rectify the situation of the homeless people so they can be geared to not be homeless. We could have money that would be able to go towards the American Indians so they would have not be wanting for anything. They would have what they need because God gave this land to them before we took it from them with Harrison and Tyler saying, who owns the land? Own the land? No, nobody owns the land, the chief said. God gave the land, the Great Spirit gave the land for everyone, every living creature. Oh, so you don't own it? We can sign here, we'll see what we can do for you. And we took, and we're still taking. And we're not tithing our 10%. We should do that. If we're not, in some cities, if you do not pay the percentage to the waiters and waitresses, you don't tip. They take it, they put it right on your ticket. They take it out. Maybe we should be doing that in Bethlehem to be an example of other cities to tithe that 10%. Now, maybe I'm just venting. But however, vetting enough that actually the Republican Party wanted to back me in a city that's Democratic. I said, you guys are crazy. You know, you want to back me to be on a Republican ticket in a Democratic city. I'm Democrat. They said, well, you got to switch to be Republican. No, 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 that's not going to happen. If you want any kind of chance, you let a Democrat that you're pushing to be into the mayor's position. Then you have a chance of winning. I should not be switching to be Democrat. I wasn't going to. So, I'm at the write-in, and I won't be elected, I'm sure. Even though I am offering to give all my money back to the city and do just as hard of a job, if not harder, than any mayor that was ever elected. But nobody went to back me up but the Republican Party, who wanted me to switch to be Republican from Democrat. That is really crazy. That is one of the craziest things I heard this millennium. It made my millennium when I heard that. But, however, it is what it is. And all we can do is keep on rocking and keep the faith and keep with God. Be one nation under God and trusting in God. Think about tithing that 10%. I'm sure the reverence behind me on that one. God bless you all. Peace.
Thank you, Mr. Caratola. That exhausts our list of who had signed up before the meeting. So I'll go around the room again on anything not being voted on this evening. Is there anyone in the Wives Center who wants to make comment? Mr. Shire?
Bill Shire, 1898 Avenue. I want to thank the pastor for providing a lead-in. I assume he was talking about Pennsylvania Avenue. I've talked to Mike about getting white lines on the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue. Although there's not a parked car problem there like there is on the east side, but there is passing on the right. It's happened to me once and to a friend of mine once, and I've told her when she comes down, drive in the middle. Otherwise, you might get surprised on the right. So, same problem, just no parked cars. And I think white lines would help. Mainly tonight, I want to follow up on some economics. I mentioned that the interest on the national debt is now 10% of the annual budget. And the way we're going, it's going to be increasing until we reach a tipping point. And the country will have to default. And because of the way we're going, we're still running big deficits, partly because of continuing the tax cuts for the wealthy. And so I have a proposal. to put forward tonight about taxation in this country. The highest tax bracket on the income tax is 37%. That kicks in at about $600,000+, which means that any income above that amount, those extra dollars are taxed at 37%. I would like to propose that we establish an additional tax bracket that kicks in at $1 million, and that's 50%. By the way, for historical comparison, after World War II, the top tax bracket was 90% because of the need, of course, to pay for the war. So 50%, now this would mean that, say, somebody earned $2 million, which I can only dream about, but the second million would be taxed at 50%, so the government would get $500,000 in taxes and the taxpayer would retain $500,000. The interesting thing is that because 50% is exactly one half, if this taxpayer were to donate the second $1 million to a bona fide charity and would only be losing $500,000, because otherwise that would be all that was left, the charity would be gaining $1 million, and where's the other $500,000 coming from? It's coming from the government, because that would be lost taxes to the government that was going to the charity. And that way, the taxpayer would be making a million dollar donation to the charity, but in effect, only losing $500,000, and the government would be making a matching grant to that charity. And that would perhaps stimulate philanthropy, because that'd be kind of a cool thing. In any event, we got to do something, because this present regime, and it's, again, to echo Harry, I mean, it's something that the Democrats and the Republicans share, although there are differences between the two parties, important differences. We can't go on like this. And these tax cuts for the wealthy, well, as Jimmy Carter has said, he said this some time ago, we are living in an oligarchy, or maybe you pronounce it oligarchy, I'm not sure. But it means controlled by the wealthy people. And that is certainly the case today with Citizens United, where the wealthy people can inundate the airwaves with their messages. Repetition breeds familiarity, and familiarity makes things seem more truthful. So there we are. I'm going to stop with 29 seconds to go. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shire. Was there anyone else in the center who would make comment? Mr. Antalik? Excuse me.
Very good. Stephen Antalik, Silverton Ridge. When local laws require city workers to live in the city, those who made the decisions had good knowledge of the city and rarely looked to outside consultants to aid in their decision making. Namely, names like DeCesso, Grubb, Brown, and Del Grasso come to mind. Today, in the local government, there's a great reliance on outside consultation in major decisions. Does this mean a lack of knowledge or a lack of confidence required by local officials to make these important decisions? Generally speaking, these outside consultants are highly qualified, intelligent persons, but the question that is raised is, what is the full extent of their knowledge of key facts and history that is required to make the most intelligent decision toward the solution of the city's problem? Ignorance of important data or knowledge in the final decision might make for an inferior result, which in some cases can be judged as simply as being stupid. This statement is rather harsh, but But then when intelligent individuals are ignorant of key facts in decision making, then those decisions can be simply evaluated as being stupid. The recent decision to make Linden Street one way and ignoring Center Street, in my estimation, is simply stupid. Why? By possibly being ignorant of or having ignored the history of the original reason for both streets originally becoming one way, here we have a classical example of ignorance leading to stupidity. This is a public meeting, and people speaking should conduct it as such. But I've observed city council members engage in what I would call tete-a-tete, which is a one-to-one discussion, conversation, not a discussion, conversation, ignoring the public. That microphone is a disservice to people sitting here. Why? Number one, when someone from the city is addressing a problem raised by someone on council, that person at that mic turns the council away from the microphone. And the person at that table turns to the person speaking, turns to that person away from their microphone. So public comment becomes tete-a-tete, totally ignoring the public. This is a public meeting, and you should speak with a public voice, not a tete-a-tete voice. You're here to serve us. We want to hear what you're saying. Also, your microphones, technically speaking, and I looked into this, should be more than 3 inches from your mouth, which is the source of your voice. So, let's be responsible to our citizens.
Thank you, Mr. Antalis. Was there anyone else in the wide center who would make comment? Doesn't have a chance. Anyone to the right? That concludes our first public comment. So we'll move on to second public comment. This is for any ordinance or resolution that's going to be voted on this evening. We did not have anyone sign up pre-meeting. So again, I'll start in the wide center. Anyone want to make comment on anything we're voting on tonight? Anyone to the right? Okay, thank you. Old business, any old business from members of council? Any new business from members of council? Councilman Leo?
Mr. Alcala, stop. Like, it's not a question, no worries. But I did want to. It's 3 inches. Am I not speaking loud enough? Is that better?
I'll just one time ask everyone to use their microphones. Okay. I'm not going to bring it up again.
So, Mr. Alcock, when the intersection that was spoken about, Gep and Maple Street, I'm looking at it, and there is some signage, look right, look left, look right, and the stop signs, but I'm just wondering if maybe some additional line painting or the refreshing of the crosswalks that are there might be helpful, or anything that could be done in that area. It does seem to be, it's right near that kind of offshoot, so it's just a difficult area. So I'm wondering what your suggestions might be to handle something in that area.
We'll definitely, we'll take a close look at it. Mm-hmm. And if there's anything that we feel would help the situation, we'd certainly follow up next week.
Awesome. I know that we're close to the end of line painting season and all that stuff.
We're struggling to finish a few things, but certainly if it's important enough, we would jump on.
Yeah, or even just looking at it for the next year of like line painting and all that stuff. Thank you.
Sure. Any other new Mayor, did you want to piggyback off of that?
I did. I just wanted to add, too, one of the things that's going on now with our complete streets plan is the idea that we're essentially distinguishing our streets from the type of traffic, how many cars, like are they essentially cars that streets that are in the middle of neighborhoods, or are they streets that have been traditionally designed to move traffic through the city as quickly as possible. I mean, and it's the kind of the pre-complete streets. It was kind of the idea that grew out of Linden Street and is growing out of Center Street when we have that funding to be able to move forward. And this is a classic example. I grew up down the street, so I used to have to walk this exact intersection. And the way the street is set up, as I was walking to Thomas Jefferson 30 years ago, was when you're coming around the bend, there was a challenge there. And some of it is the way the street is designed. So ultimately, when we take a look through this complete streets plan, and we make a determination about what these different type of streets are, what we want them to be, because we have some safe streets in Bethlehem. We have streets that have a substantial amount of traffic, but people don't feel as if they're dangerous because they're not. So essentially looking at what's working, and then this would be the type of place where ultimately the city will have to make some type of infrastructure decision. As Mr. Alcalm talked about Linden Street, I mean, that's going to be a project that has been years in the making, that has been supported by our LDTS money that comes through the Lehigh Valley Planning Commission, like related to it. But that was a project where we had neighbors show up, we had Northside Alive and things like that. That's going to be $2 million to turn that one-way street into a two-way street for probably about, I'd say a little bit less than half a mile, probably about 0.4. So the price is going to be substantial, but it's going to be an opportunity for us to take a look at what some of these streets are. I mean, it's what we're doing with Broad Street. And this area there, when you're coming around the bend on Gap Street and you're passing past Elm, like you go past Elm first, then you go past Maple, and then you get up to Linden. And if people hit that light, they just keep going. So it is an opportunity for us to take a look at it. But that's like one of those streets that we're going to be able to make some real decisions about that aren't going to be cheap, but ultimately would move to fix this problem, because it's not going to be just an enforcement situation or signage and things like that. It's going to have to be some street changes.
Yeah, and I do appreciate like the more comprehensive approach to it. It is not good practice for us to like wait for people to come to council or to like drive around and say, obviously this is an area that needs repair. And I appreciate the flexibility of Public Works to always like rise to the occasion. You guys have shown up for the Indian Hill community, for the community over at Pennsylvania Ave. But obviously we do need a more comprehensive approach than just nitpicking.
And obviously we will do everything we can in the short term to see about what are the type of measures that can be used to be able to cut down the speed and things like that. I'm just being completely transparent and honest with you. It's like the solution for the most dangerous streets in the city is to take away the opportunity to speed.
Yeah.
Like it's car culture is out of control everywhere, including in the city of Bethlehem. And a big, big piece of that is how we view our streets and how we build our streets.
Any other new business from our council? Councilwoman Francis Smith?
Yeah, regarding this, if it's the same intersection I'm thinking of, it's Gep and Maple, where there's a three-way stop and then one is right through. I actually emailed, I want to say about 2 or 3 months ago, I emailed and included pictures of accidents, because I've had several people come reach out to me, some that live on Maple, with real concerns about this intersection. So I believe I emailed Tiffany, and I thought I emailed Public Works, and I'm not sure, but I don't know if anybody recalls that email, but it was specifically regarding this intersection. So I have to just say I've had, in addition to people here tonight, I've had several people come to me because they live right there and they've seen a lot of accidents, and as well as have neighbors whose cars have been totaled. So it's great that we're doing a big street plan and everything else, but I think that I would really appreciate it if we could prioritize this and look at it, because like I said, I did send an email out because of the concerns. And I think it's obviously a street that really needs to be looked at. I know I go by there myself, and it is like people fly down Gap because they don't have the stop sign, but then the other three, there's a stop sign at the other areas, and even the visibility is a little tough leaving Maple. So I appreciate that.
I'll just note, Councilwoman, and I don't know the full scope of who you emailed, but are you referencing Tiffany Wells?
Yes, I did definitely include her.
Tiffany Wells left the city to go work for the parking authority. I just know that through general practice, so that's just something that I don't know if that.
But I didn't just email her. I did email. I think it was Public Works and perhaps the police. I'm not sure. I can go back and resend that email. Maybe there was a glitch, but I know I definitely sent it because of concerns. So just wanted to bring that up again. I had some other things under, I guess, old business and new business. I'm not sure where we are. Is it okay to go?
Yeah, all right. New business. Go ahead.
I was just wondering, I know I missed the last meeting, the meeting prior, we talked a lot about housing and the crisis, especially with the folks down by the river. And I was wondering if there was any follow-up administratively, as far as we talked a lot about Martin Tower and trying to look at connecting with the people there, the developers again, about getting the residential part going and considering the LERTA for that area. Has there been any follow-up with that?
I think we had sent some information to City Council about what kind of the history was and the current position there moving forward. As I've said, you know, we've spent a lot of time. I know we're currently working on things having to do with the CRIS increment for the medical office building, so we're having ongoing conversations with the owners of the property. But I'm not sure if Ms. Collins wanted to add anything to that or not. But that was part of the purpose of the email that Ms. Collins had sent a while ago, basically stating what we were looking for from planning type purposes moving forward. And that if the property owners were looking for a zoning change, that's within their power to be able to move forward. But our kind of public policy position on the development site and doing something that is neighborhood appropriate is consistent with that, like the email that Ms. Collins had sent to everybody.
Is there anything else? I mean, I don't recall seeing that email. I've been out of the country for a couple of weeks, but I'll have to see if I find that email. But again, I guess I will just say again, as I said at the other meeting, I think especially we're in a real housing crisis even more so. Given, you know, the increasing number of the homeless, then I think it would just be really a viable option to sit down and consider, you know, especially the LERTA, because I think it already is designated as a blighted area, and we can not only get more residential units, hundreds, which, you know, I keep being told that we need, but also get multi-millions in affordable housing from the LERTA. So my only other, the other question I had is, I know there was some discussion about the police and the complement at the last meeting, but I was wondering, Chief Griffin, not to put you on the spot, but I'm just wondering where we're at with the firefighters, if you can just give us an idea on, you know, the numbers we have and what the complement is and how many firefighters, are we at complement or are we down firefighters at this point?
So currently, when we're fully staffed, our number is 104 firefighters, including the deputy fire chief and myself. Currently, we are 8 positions down as we stand here today.
And do we have anybody, I know we've had a lot of people that we've gone through the academy. Do we have anybody at the academy now, or are we what are you doing as far as trying to fill those 8 positions?
So we currently have 4 recruits in the Allentown Fire Academy that are scheduled to graduate on November the, I believe, 13th. Don't quote me, I'd have to check my calendar, but they have about a month left of the academy we'll be graduating for. All 4 are doing very well. We don't expect any problems with them graduating, and they'll be joining us toward the end of November on the street.
Okay, great. As a result, so if we're down 8, are we seeing a lot of need to use overtime in the department more than usual, given the vacancies?
Yes, there's been a good amount of overtime in the department throughout this past calendar year. We've done our best to hire. Unfortunately, when we put those 4 individuals through the fire academy, we were scheduled to actually put 6 individuals through the fire academy. 2 of the individuals made an error in judgment, didn't show up for necessary appointments that were required, and unfortunately we were left with 2 vacancies. We could not fill those spots in time. So that put us in a tough spot for this entire academy class. It's going to be 1 year until we can fill those spots.
So we're not, so we have to wait a whole other year for the next academy, you mean, until we can fill the other 4?
From that point that they were hired. So the next fire academy is scheduled to start in January. So this would have been last January. We have to wait till this January to fill them.
And do we have 4 people slated to go in January?
So we are currently in the process of interviewing. We're working with Human Resources. Captain Small, the training captain, is conducting background investigations and background interviews now of individuals. And the deputy chief and myself will be doing the formal employment interviews with all of those individuals throughout the week next week.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And to add to that, in the budget, so once again, the plan is to send 2 classes next year. So if we have 8 vacancies in December, then we can hire 8 people. They start to be on the payroll, but obviously they have to go to the academy. So then, if that's the number that we have as far as vacant is concerned in December, then we send 8 people to the academy, then they get here in June. But then, as we've talked about over the past couple of years, and as we're putting in the budget, we're expecting to send a second class in the middle of the year. So we are actually putting in the budget, the number is, I believe, 15. So to send those 8 to the academy in January, with the idea that because additional retirements occur in February or March or May or whenever it might be. So, like, we can't send 15 people in December because then you're double paying people and people haven't said if they're going to retire or not. You're just assuming that they may. So once we get through this next particular year, we are going to be based on, and Chief Griffin could tell you this much better than I could, is that there's a period of time about 25 years ago when for about 3 or 4 years, like a whole bunch of people retired and we hired a whole bunch of people. And now over the past couple of years, there's a whole bunch of people that are retiring and we're hiring a whole bunch of people. So Chief Griffin might know the exact number, but we went from a period where the majority of our officers were probably over 15 years to now the majority of our firefighters are probably, I don't know, 5, 6. I think we just were talking about this the other day, like 30 in the last 3 years or something like that.
Upon this graduating class, we have 33 firefighters with under 3 years of service in the Bethlehem Fire Department. That is a huge number.
Yeah.
We've gone through a lot of firefighters. We've had a lot of retirements, as the mayor says.
Yeah, and if you go back, we had 30-some firefighters under 3 years of experience in 2003 because it was essentially the same part. So we are, but that's the plan, Councilwoman, is that we are going to send the maximum amount that we're able to send in January, but then we also are putting in the budget once again for two classes to be able to send that, you know, potentially up to 7. As Chief Griffin said, sometimes things happen where you go through the process. In this situation with those two particular applicants, we spent all the time, all the money, all the backgrounds to get to the point. They had to do something. I mean, it's America, it's their choice. They chose not to do that. It was the week before the academy started, I believe. Was that correct? A week or two before?
Yes, sir.
So there was no way for us to then hire 6 and take 2 and put them there and so on and so forth with that same class. So that's why the 6 and 4. But in the budget for next year, we will have enough to send 15 people to the academy.
Okay, great. And do you have any idea, anticipating retirements, what number that will look like for next year?
I really don't. I can look at the number of years of service and I can tell you how many people are eligible, but I have no idea what people's personal intentions are, and nor are they required to share those with us.
Yeah, and
I
can't exactly figure it out either, but there were less retirements actually when there were more openings. But now as the openings are being filled, and now there's less openings, and I'm not sure whether or not it's connected to overtime at all or not. I couldn't imagine it would be, that people then are choosing to retire rather than stay working. So it actually turns out that, like, as you fill more positions, you actually get more retirements. Like I said, I've never been able to conclusively figure out why that is. You know, people have theories about that. But as we fill these positions, you'll probably see some other people that make the determination to go sooner rather than later, which is why we're putting 7 additional in for next year. But like we said, as of this period, I believe we're at 8 for the vacancies.
That is correct.
That's correct, yeah. So we're going to send the maximum amount that we're able to send.
We also have other individuals who are out long-term with health issues that do play into the overtime issue. Unfortunately, we have some individuals battling some pretty severe health conditions at this time. So, unfortunately, they're not able to be with us right now, although I know they wish they could.
Are they included in the 8, or is that above and beyond the 8?
The 8 is the number we're short.
Right.
Those individuals who are out sick or injured are on our roster. They're just not able to report to work at this time.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Any other new business from Councilwoman Laird?
Yes, so at our last meeting, I think this would be for either Mayor Reynolds or Laura, Ms. Collins. At our last meeting, I asked a little bit about the food co-op question that came up from a different member of the public. And did get answers for basic oversight of grant funding. So I'm recalling that the federal grant, which is the largest that particular organization received, is a reimbursement grant, and that the expenses being asked for reimbursement are reviewed by, I believe you said, HUD and the controller. Is that correct? So the question was raised tonight of if there's an independent person reviewing expenses, and the answer to that is yes, there is. Just want to, even though we went over that last time, want to reiterate it since someone else brought it up today. Is the process for oversight of that funding for the food co-op different than any other organization that we pass through funding for or grant CDBG dollars to.
No, the process would be the same.
Okay,
you know,
so
every year we have, you know, as the city council knows, there's a list of organizations that receive funding through the CDBG allocation, and you know, there's a robust process that applies to all grantees, which includes both, you know, city review, but that is all, CDBG is also HUD money, so that also has oversight and monitoring from HUD as well.
Okay, and the controller.
Right, and right. So anytime that dollars go out the door from the city, whether they're grant dollars or general fund dollars, you know, whatever the case may be, like there is a process by which the controller's office reviews, you know, anything, whether it's a grant or otherwise.
Okay. And is there a requirement within, for any organization then, if it's all the same, that they are successful in their project timeline, et cetera? Is that like, so I'm thinking of, I mean, something that we all want to see open, the emergency shelter, right? And we're carrying over some funds for while they get their act together in terms of staffing, and not that they aren't doing a ton of work, but like while they transition to potentially a year-round model, et cetera. So those dollars are carried over. Is that, in my head, it seems sort of parallel, but is it the same process?
I guess how I would answer that is, with respect to grants generally, each funding source is different, but almost all funding sources have, you know, a grant period, which, you know, the end of the grant period would be the time within which, you know, you or the recipient is expected to complete a project. You know, there are many situations where, you know, depending on the project and the situation, you might go back to the grant funder and say, you know, here are the reasons why this project wasn't done within the timeline. Can we have an amendment to our grant agreement, you know, to extend the time by which we can complete this project? But really, it is pretty much grant and project specific in that regard.
Have there needed to be any amendments to the funds that were approved for the food co-op?
No, we're still within the timeline for the community project funding or the congressionally directed spending.
Okay.
Congressionally directed spending for this.
Okay.
Project.
And then recognizing or clarifying, I believe the commenter had indicated that it's a government-run grocery, which it is not. It's a community-owned grocery store. But is the city working with the co-op board and members to assist while not owning the co-op or the funding for it? Can you describe a little bit about, you know, what you've done in that process?
Yeah, so I would start with the obvious, and I think everybody knows Mr. Verdone, he has been the one that has been working with the co-op as far as their HUD reimbursements are concerned and things like that. So the majority of what our assistance has been, obviously, is like we are the ones that the grant passed through, as we are with CDBG and HUD, with all sorts of different organizations. So that's probably, if you look at the total amount of time that is spent, I would say that his time is probably number one as far as that is concerned. We have had other conversations with the co-op, and as you know, a former board member, like the co-op model was, and there were things that Mr. O'Hara had said that some of which I agree with, but when he talked about being $1 million in debt, what they have said publicly is that a co-op, by definition, relies on their members for member loans and member supports and things like that. So it is a community-owned grocery store and things like that. Where the co-op has asked us for strategic kind of advice about, and this is my number, not theirs, like I believe that they're about 95% of the way there as far as like the funding is concerned to be able to get it open based on what they have spent over the past several years as far as fit out and things like that are concerned. We've had conversations with them when they have, you know, asked us for what our advice is. I would be lying to you if I said there weren't moments of frustration that I think that they haven't necessarily shared with all of the members and all of the community to the extent that they could about what are some very legitimate reasons why that project has slowed down, including things having to do with materials, including things having to do with personnel, things that just happen when somebody is trying to get a business up off the ground. Like, I and we do not believe that has necessarily been laid out in a way that gives all of the members the opportunity to understand what some of their different pressure points have been. It, as you know, you know, it is a situation where it is a lot of work to be a member of this board. None of us are members of this board. They are a co-op. We have tried to tell them that they need to recruit more members, they need to recruit more people, to be honest, that they need more people to be able to volunteer, to be able to specialize in different things and things like that. So I would tell you that both it's a project that has gone through all of the same requirements as far as, you know, purchasing this fit out for, or purchasing this and then sending it to the federal government and then they check it's okay and so on and so forth. So they are trying to start a business that obviously is difficult like any business right now. With that being said, I think that it is at a time where they need to be a little bit flexible in the manner in which they're going to open this grocery store. And I think that is shared by a lot of people. It's shared by a lot of members. And I don't say those words lightly, but it is a topic that obviously we get questions about as well. And we are not the decision makers. We are not the board members. The city, going back to when Mayor Donches was around and then the $2.9 million that Congresswoman Wilde had to get was when the Donches administration. But this has been a project that has gotten a lot of public funding, and it's also gotten a lot of money from people within the community. So we have tried to get across to the co-op that they need to set a date to open their grocery store, that they need to be honest about what the different challenges are, and that they need to recruit more people and tell people this is what we need from our cooperative members in our community to be able to make this project happen. I've also been honest with them that, quite honestly, I think that their current board structure that has term limits has not been conducive to building confidence with institutional investors and things like that, because it makes people leave that are good people, and sometimes it's a lot of work. I think if you ever look at any board, this is more work than I think you'd find in just about anywhere else. So we have both communicated that verbally, we have communicated that in writing. Where there has been a question of like, what do you guys think we should do? We have said like, this is what we think is the best way for you to move forward in this way. This is what we think is how you should talk to, you know, Institution A or Institution B and things like that. But we can only provide advice. They need to take it. And at times they have, and at times they have not. And, you know, we share some of the frustrations. With that being said, I do honestly believe that the project is like 95% of the way there financially. They're dealing with the same cost overruns we hear about in housing, that we hear about in business, that we hear about everywhere else. So we are hopeful that they come forward with a plan in the near future to be able to announce a start date, which we don't think is that far away, that will allow them to open the doors and continue the confidence that everybody's built over the last 15 years in being part of that project.
Great, thank you. I think that at this point that's all the questions I have. If there were specifics about what sort of things, where they're at with reimbursements and from particularly the largest of the grants, that would be Mr. Vidoni, who is the person overseeing of that. Okay, thank you.
We do think that, like I said, I think about the $2.9 million, I think it's like $2.8 something that has been spent, reimbursed, and then spent, approved by HUD, and reimbursed. So I think
that's correct.
I think it's just that's just about done.
Okay. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Mr. Gallagher?
Mayor, I couldn't agree with you more as far as the their bylaws, as far as the term limits on the people that are leading there. I mean, I was really surprised to find out that Carol Ritter, who was I guess the president here for a while, and I thought she was doing a great job, but you know, I found out that she wasn't going to be on the board anymore because she was term limited. So I think everybody in the city wants to see that open up, but it's time that they get moving on it. So I couldn't agree with you more on it. As far as the tower site, most of you know that I know Mr. Ronca very well. I've had numerous discussions with him in the last year and a half. There is no plan. They do not have any plan to go to zoning and ask for any type of zoning variances. They're allowed, I think, to, what, 1080?
1085.
Yeah. They did what they were thinking at one point, maybe 2-3 years ago, to go to 1700 units. They're not doing that. They haven't had that in their head for over a year and a half now. From what I understand, it's even under 900 units, which they're already zoned for, so they don't need any additional zoning. I will say this, there is absolutely no plan that they will, they've submitted nothing to you guys, correct? And there is nothing that they will submit because the financials don't make sense right now. It's going to sit there for four more years until there's leadership, you know, on all levels that are going to understand it. That is a very difficult project. It's not like they walked out and bought farmland and they could just start building. Did they get RCAP money? Yeah, they got, I think, $8 or $9 million. But they also have tens of millions of dollars invested in the property. And I think we should be, I mean, if people knew the total amount that they have in, but it's probably the most expensive land in eastern Pennsylvania, an acre. And it's a shame that it is going to sit there for another 4 years. Especially, I think if we sat down, if everybody knew what the numbers were, and this is off the top of my head, I mean, I don't, there was an article today in the Morning Call about the Glendon, what was it called, the Glendon Hotel. That project, that affordable housing project, is not going through at all. And the people that owned it cited the same reasons that nothing's going to go on at the tower. Interest rates are extremely high, and more importantly, the cost of all the building materials are extremely high. That was the reason why they decided to move away from the 1,700 units there, because the only way they could do that is if they dug holes in the ground and put all the surface parking underneath the new apartment buildings, which is astronomically expensive. So that's when they just decide, you know what, it's unfeasible. So they won't, they're not even interested in going to zoning to ask for zoning changes for more additional units there. I'm just being honest with everybody. I don't know if it's an FYI or if people want to see what we can do, but the same reasons why the Glen Hotel's not going through is the same reason why they're not going to submit any plans for at least 4 years until things change. And we can sit here and say they had enough. You know, they had Chris Acreage, which could be part of a negotiation, right? So Chris Acreage, which they have to sign off on, correct? Right? There's the in lieu of fee. I wasn't on council at the time. Most everybody else here was, except myself and Ms. Laird. But I don't know what that letter from Mr. Herrick was. I think that was based on the 1,700 units that they wanted to do at the time. So I don't know what the number would be. I think at that time it was $7-8 million they were throwing around it, you know, as far as the move fees. So maybe it's like four now. I don't know. I'm just throwing out the number. Mm-hmm. But it's just not the in lieu of fee. It's the rec fees. How much are rec fees around? 1,500?
It's a calculation based on the number of units in the acreage.
Yeah, so it's rec fees. It's additional, you know, you said it, Becky Bradley said it. I think the number that was brought up was about almost 1,000 units short. That's, if that's the number they wanted to do, 880, I mean, that's a huge chunk off of releasing some of the pressures off of the housing rental unit pressure. I mean, in my mind, and I'm going to get a phone call in a couple of days when he finds out about me talking about it again, because every time I talk about it, you know, he drops an F-bomb and he stops talking about it, you know, because he's, there's nothing going on. And Mr. Reynolds, you know that, and so does Ms. Collins. They have not brought it up to you guys at all, within the last 2 years. There's been no discussion at all with the remaining property. I just think it's a shame that we have that property, the affordable housing property that's going up on the south side, right? On 4th Street. How many units is that?
120.
And the land was donated, so the land's free. And we just got a $15 million grant you got from Ms. Buscola?
Well, I'm sorry, from who?
Ms. Buscola, you know, from the state.
From PHFA.
Right.
It was the low income tax grant. It's the $16 million percent.
Yeah, but I think
I'm sorry, $60 million, 9% tax credits. That ran through Penrose's application that Sarah and Laura put together over a period of months.
Yeah, so how much money? Isn't that like an 80%
of the tax rate or whatever. Don't we get like, it comes out to like $13 million or $14 million, I thought.
$16 million. It's 1.8 over 10 years, and then with the, yeah, I think it's like a 90%.
And how much money do we need total to do those 100 and what?
120, there's two different phases, but and Penrose is the developer that is partnering on doing that.
And what was the total cost, you know?
Roughly each phase, I think, is around $25 million.
For each phase?
Yeah.
Okay. $250 million?
For what?
$50 million.
Oh, $50 million.
Yeah, so, I mean, everybody can see how expensive it is at 4 miles.
So one of the things Mr. Calley and I would tell you is just as a general, if you take a look at when LRTs have been used, they've been used in areas, blighted areas, whether or not it was South Bethlehem or Northside. So like the kind of intellectual merits behind one has been the idea that like this is an area, whether or not it's old steel site or whatever it could be. As a concept, and I believe Ms. Collins put this in her email as well.
Did you, Ms. Collins?
About the idea of somebody saying, I won't do anything here until I get a tax incentive, becomes very, very dangerous in the sense that like nobody will then do anything under the idea that I will sit here and allow this to happen. But to your point though, moving forward, one of the things that we are actually looking at as like another option there, if you were gonna create a one-off LRTA, is like, is there a way, rather than just taking money out as far as like a payment in lieu of, is like, could you sign a master lease with somebody like New Bethany or somebody for a certain percentage of units to be able to create mixed income units in the same spot by subsidizing those rents with money that comes in as far as the payment in lieu of, or not? Or just basically say like, you're gonna create a percentage there, but the requirement then is that you, however long the tax incentive is, 10, 15, 20 years, that there is a complementary master lease to be able to essentially create a different version of Gateway on 4th in what were previously going to be market rate only units.
So I think you've had the discussion with them, right? They've already said it's a non-starter, right?
Why is it a non-starter?
Because they aren't putting affordable housing in there. They will pay the in lieu of fee.
Yes, and, right? And I find, so, and we find that concept,
right.
The idea that like I can pay out of what my affordable housing is, many of us choose to live in, and this is, I think this is just an ideological difference, Mr. Callahan, that, right. that people have. And I would tell you that I don't know what the percentages of people in the city that necessarily agree with this. It could be 66, 67%, almost 70%. I'm not sure what the number is. But like that, think of the idea of living in mixed income neighborhoods, especially when you look at what the restrictions are now for us to be able to build things such as we were talking about with Gateway and 4th, the amount of work that it's going to take. Is like, how are we able to design other mixed income type of neighborhoods? Now, nobody is saying that you have to do that. You have the ability to be able to go out and do what is your legal American property rights, to be able to build whatever you'd like to build on your own property that fits into zoning, no matter the income limits. Like, we live in America, you can do that. But in exchange, if you're gonna get a public benefit, like these goals that we're talking about as far as affordable housing and things like that, we want them to be met. And
are there any other LRTAs in this? I don't think there's any other LRTAs where we put constraints on.
We're looking at the model. That's what I started this conversation with. Yeah. And so like, if you were going to have a one-off LRTA rather than a blighted area LRTA such as the former Bethlehem Steel site and so on and so forth, if somebody was going to come forward with a LRTA and we were going to present it to the city council and presented to the school district and presented to Northampton County and so on and so forth, and you ask the very legitimate question that some people would say is like, why would you offer a one-off to them and not to them over there? So what the idea would be is that we would be creating an incentive that somehow, like, if you want a one-off LRTA that doesn't fit into another regional kind of area based on Bethlehem Steel or whatever it might be, this is what the deal is going to be, and it's going to be a good deal for people of mixed income throughout the city of Bethlehem. And like I said, so we're researching that. So all I'm saying is like we have concerns about one-off because the moment that you say no to them and you say yes to them, other people are like, I'm not doing anything because that person waited. So what we're trying to do is get around that by coming out with something that skips all these intermediate steps and just creates the outcome that we're looking for, which is that if you're going to take public tax dollars, you're going to create a long-term commitment to people of affordability. Now, if they choose not to do that because they don't think they can market that way and so on and so forth, That's their right.
I don't think it's that they won't. I think it's that they can't because the numbers don't
the numbers don't make sense.
And I think that's part of the equation to work out. It's like whether or not if somebody is giving, because if somebody just builds market rate housing, like what they're paying in taxes, like you could always take as the city, like whatever that number is, and just take that delta between what the LRTA was going to be, and just take that and put it towards housing. So like the idea of not doing that, and you're going to give a reduction in that, or a payment in lieu of, if we're trying to find a way for affordable housing to exist, what better way to be able to then say, okay, if you're building 100 units, that we're going to be able to make 10 or 15 or 20%, and potentially even it could be a sliding scale, as far as like what you're, and I don't know what the numbers are. That's what I'm saying. It's like, maybe you do 10 units, and like then we take the money that you were paying as a payment in lieu of, and like work with another nonprofit to be able to lease these out and so on and so forth. Maybe you want to take more tax dollars. We extend how what the percentage of people are that are living there, whether or not they're 30 or 50 or 70 or 80 or 90%.
I agree with you. What I'm saying is that discussion is not even going on right now.
Because we're still researching what that model is. I'm being completely transparent about that.
Yeah.
Is that
Ms. Collins
and myself and Mr. Spurk are trying to determine before we're able to bring it forward.
I appreciate that because it's brought up all the time about the housing. And when I sit there and I get the amount of money that we're losing, the city's losing, because we're not doing, and I know if you want to call it a one-off, that's not a one-off. That's probably the most undeveloped land in the city right now. And we have LRTAs all over it. The whole point of the LRT is to try to stimulate the projects getting done in very difficult areas. And that's already been, it's already been blighted. It is a blighted area already. The city blighted it. You know, I think Ms. Collins, I think it was in, I think your predecessor had it blighted, the Martin Tower site.
Yeah, I believe so. And then also we blighted it under an affordable housing LRTA equivalent through the state probably about 2 years ago.
I'm just throwing the numbers out there off the top of my head. We're losing about 5 million. It's not, I know you had said before that it's a tax break. Well, it's not a tax. They're not getting a tax break. They're getting it's new revenues. They pay 50% if they had alerted because it's 10. You know, it's 50% over 10 years. It's 10% the first year, 20% the second year, 30, 40, and 50 for all the continuous years. It comes out to 50%. They'd be paying 50% in taxes over a 10-year period. And that is an enormous amount of money that we will not get the way things are going right now. It's sitting there. And it's going to sit there for another 4.5 years until, you know, the economics change on it. And we all know that the economics aren't changing right now. So we either sit there and let it sit there for 4 more years. They've already sat on it for, I think, what, 15 years? And I don't know if everybody knows this, but especially the new people on council, that project has changed numerous times. Originally, when the developers bought that project, it was all going to be residential. It was all going to be residential. And then in 2010, I think it was, the housing market collapsed and the financial chaos, and residential units were no longer marketable. You know, there were a dime a dozen. You couldn't even sell your house. So that's when it came into council. I think Mr. Evans, I think you were the one, and I was on council at the time too. We changed the zoning to allow more commercial. And then a few years after that, the commercial market collapsed. And, you know, and people were, a lot of malls were closing down. So the life of that whole property has changed multiple times. And I'm just saying it's going to sit there for, it's already paid for. So we either let it sit there and it does nothing to help us for the next 4 years, or we try to come up with a plan that's workable for the developers and for the city. And I just think if we can add 880 units to the city's supply of rental units, that's a huge plus. It's a huge, huge way of going towards 1,000. You know, you said that we're short of. There's about $4.5 to $5 million in lieu of money coming in. There's rec fees at, you know, at $1,500 a unit. If there's 1,000 units, that's $1.5 million. And then you got the EIT tax I mean, someone's going to be living there. I mean, if they're making, let's say they're making $65,000 a year, that's $650,000 a year extra to the city. That's not even counting all the scholarship taxes and the county taxes. So we either try to work something out and we get all these benefits and we get all this money, or we don't try to work it out and the property sits there for four more years until things change. I don't know. I told a couple of people on council already, I'm not pushing it. But I'm not going to sit here and just let and not discuss it, because I think the city taxpayers are losing millions of dollars, and the city's actually losing millions of dollars that we could use towards affordable housing. I mean, off the top of my head, it's like $6.5 million when you add everything up. And that doesn't even count all the additional pros of trying to get a plan together over there. Otherwise, it's just going to sit there. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I think someone's got to step up and look at the hard numbers and come back and report this so we know what amount of money we're talking about that we're losing on a yearly basis. Someone's got to do that. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Callahan. Any other new business from members of council? Councilwoman Kleitek.
I would just like to thank the Bethlehem Health Bureau for a great trunk or treat last night on Hero Plaza. There were hundreds, more than 1,000 little kids. The Moravian cheerleaders, the Lehigh women's basketball team. It was a great event. I had never been to one of these before. In my capacity as a board member for the library, two other fellow board members and I staffed the table and gave away books and candy, mostly books, to all the kids. And it was just an incredible night. And I know Mayor Reynolds, you were there with Leo, and he was having a hard time picking a book, but very adorable. And just to remind folks what a treasure we have in the Bethlehem Area Public Library. Having the privilege to serve on the board now has really given me a window into the services and how they serve every part of our community and outlying areas as well. It's been a really educational experience for me. Mr. Evans, I recall the first couple of years, and I know this was still post-COVID and everything, we had to move extra money into overtime for the fire department, didn't we?
Yes, both police and fire, if over time budget becomes
right.
What we need to look at,
right.
It moves inversely with the salaries line.
Right.
If you have overtime, it's because you have open seats.
So you move it
so
to
we
salary,
have money in the salaries account that would move into the overtime. And we plan to do that this year with, both again, both police and fire. It's something we've done through time. We budget that every seat is full. That's what we do for every position throughout. That's standard policy. But when there are openings, it does drive the overtime. It typically will balance, and we'll bring a memo to you. We did request a finance meeting for December 2nd. I don't know if that's been confirmed or announced yet. For an opportunity for us to present the budget, the audit, which is near completion. It's almost signed off. We'll have that completed. We'll do that December 2nd, as well as the public safety memos to square it all up for the year.
Great. And so do you anticipate it's going to be about the same as it's been in the last few years, or is it more or less?
I think it's a little less than last year as we continue to work through. Yeah, we'll have the numbers.
It feels
though.
Like it's coming later than it did. There was one particular time when it was kind of a big.
We usually wait towards the end so we know what it is versus making transfers. You know, we know what the number is now. We track by each payday. We're looking at all the payrolls, the accounts, the overtimes, and finding, number one, what that number might be. We call it like the burn rate. Like, what is the average overtime over each payroll? What's what we call the vacancy factor? You know, salary budget divided by 26 is a number. If it's less than that, we know it's creating savings in the salaries line. So we'll run those calculations as late as we can with maybe one or two payrolls left. That's why we wait till December, because then we have pretty firm numbers when you're in the end.
Thanks.
That's the reason for that. Sure.
And I want to also thank you and your team and Mr. Alcall's team.
the public safety team, everybody who has sat down with us and run through the five-year capital program and really helped us understand how those numbers add up. It's a tremendous undertaking, and I just want to reiterate my appreciation for that. And Mr. Alcall, I will be sending an email. Another constituent does request a line, so I'll be in touch about that. I don't need to bring it up to you now, but the word is getting out that you're responsive, and people are coming up to me and saying, you know, there's a street. So anyway, but I'll be in touch. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilwoman. Chief Cock, can you come to the microphone, please? I just have a question. As you approach, I'll start my comment. So it came up during public comment about a problematic establishment. I know it was reported in local media. I know these come up from time to time. Can you just briefly re-educate me about, as it relates to nuisance bars, what the process is with the Liquor Control Board or Liquor Control Enforcement, and the challenges that your department has and that we have as a city in terms of shutting down an establishment? I know the state plays a role in them, and I mean, we've heard tonight and other nights about problematic places. There's been different ones over the years that come up. Can you just speak on what has to happen for there to be some kind of intervention, like a liquor license being revoked or anything like that?
Absolutely. So we cannot revoke an establishment's liquor license. That has to come through the Liquor Control Board. And we are actively working with the Liquor Control Board, LCB, in regard to the 540 Club. And there are two ways that an establishment can be designated as a nuisance bar. It can come through the Liquor Control Board, through that avenue, or it can come through the district attorney's office. It's usually easier and more common if it comes through the Liquor Control Board. This is something that we're actively working on with outside parties. It can be very frustrating just because we're working with another agency that's on its own timeline and has its own fact-finding and procedures in place to go about revoking that liquor license and to go about, you know, trying to work with, ultimately their goal is to try to get compliance and try to get the establishment to start following the rules and to tighten things up so there are no issues. So we're currently working with the Liquor Control Board to try to make sure that establishment cleans up its act.
If there's an incident outside of an establishment, let's say that, you know, I run a bar and there's some kind of fight or violent event in the parking lot, but we know it originated inside, is the establishment dinged for that?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And then can you speak to what the threshold is? Are there so many citations that a place has to receive? Is there a point system, like, you know, heaven forbid something like a shooting elevates it to here right away versus repeated noise violations or fights? Can you speak to sort of what puts them at risk?
It's all of the above.
Okay.
They will take anything from complaints to DUIs to fights, to these aggravated assaults, you know, involving firearms, to citizens calling to complain. That's another huge factor when individuals reach out to my office to complain about nuisance bars, potential nuisance bars. We always tell them, make sure you reach out to the Liquor Control Board and report that, because, you know, the citizen weight behind those complaints is very, very heavy and can help speed up the process.
Okay. Thank you, Chief. I appreciate the background on that. Councilwoman, yeah?
If I could just follow up on that, every liquor license, there's a regular renewal period, right?
Which I believe is coming up in May.
Okay.
When last I spoke to the LCB agent that we've been dealing with.
Okay. Because it seems like we've been hearing about this for a while now, and I don't know, is it every 2 years? I mean, how often is the renewal?
I believe it's every 2 years, okay. But don't quote me.
Good, okay. It's really beyond time to do something. And I understand why they, you know, their incentive is compliance, because they don't want to pull liquor licenses because we make money off the taxes of, you know, I get that. However, you know, public safety should always still be paramount. And so thank you for, again, you know, continuing. And I know that the neighbors in the neighborhood know that the city is trying, but I can understand their frustration too.
Any other new business for members of council? So before we continue, we have to talk about rescheduling the Tuesday, November 4th, 2025 city council meeting. That's election day. City hall will be closed. So to reschedule to Wednesday, November 5th. And I will accept a motion and a second to reschedule our first meeting in November to Wednesday, November 5th with the 7 p.m. start time due to the general election.
So moved.
Second.
Motion by Councilwoman Kubitschek, seconded by Councilwoman Leone. Any discussion? Mr. Miller, please call the roll.
Ms. Leone?
Aye.
Ms. Wilhelm?
Aye.
Mr. Callahan?
Aye.
Ms. Ramsey Smith?
Aye.
Ms. Kubitschek?
Aye.
Ms. Laird?
Aye.
And Mr. Cologne?
Aye. Passes 7-0. So the first city council meeting in November has been rescheduled to Wednesday, November 5th at 7 p.m. here at Town Hall. And that is custom that we do every year. Moving on to communications, 6A.
An October 14th, 2025 memorandum from John F. Spurk Jr. with an attached use permit agreement and resolution. Permittee is Arts Quest and the event is the 2025 Chris Kindle Market. Activities will be held Thursdays through Sundays, November 14th through December 21st, during the following times. Fridays and Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 8 p.m. and Thursdays and Sundays from 10 a.m. until 6 p.m. Premises will include First Street from Founders Way to the Eastern Terminus.
And Resolution 10A is on the agenda. 6B.
An October 14th, 2025 memorandum from Solicitor John F. Spurk Jr. with an attached use permit and resolution. Permittee is the Greater Lehigh Valley Chamber of Commerce Foundation by and through with Citizens Christmas City Committee. And the sub-permittees are Country Club Brewing LLC, Franklin Hill Vineyards Incorporated, and Social Still LLC. The event is the 2025 Christmas Trees Lighting Ceremony. The events will be held on November 28th from 4:30 to 7 p.m. The premises will be Payro Plaza and the south side lane of Church Street in front of City Hall and the Library Complex.
And Resolution 10B is also on the agenda tonight. 6C.
An October 14th, 2025 memorandum from Solicitor John F. Spurk Jr. with an attached use permit agreement and resolution. Permittee is the Greater Lehigh Valley Chamber of Commerce by and through its Downtown Bethlehem Association, and the joining party is the Redevelopment Authority of the City of Bethlehem. The event is the 2025 Christmas City Village. Activities will be held Fridays and Saturdays from noon to 8 p.m. and Sundays from noon to 6 p.m. between November 14th and December 21st.
Resolution 10C is on the agenda. 16.
An October 14th, 2025 memorandum and proposed resolution from Stephen Pallone, Superintendent of Water Supply and Treatment. Mr. Pallone recommends an agreement with JCI Jones Chemicals Incorporated, Sarasota, Florida, to provide chlorine cylinders to both the water treatment plant and wastewater treatment plant for disinfection. Total cost for a year supply is $204,490. Four annual renewals are offered at the same annual price, which would total $817,960 if all contract renewals would be exercised. The vendor was the low bidder.
Resolution 10D, also on the agenda tonight, 6E.
An October 14th, 2025 memorandum and proposed resolution from Superintendent of Water Supply and Treatment, Stephen Pallone. Mr. Pallone recommends an agreement with Univar Solutions USA, LLC, at Morrisville, Pennsylvania, to provide sodium hydroxide to the water treatment plant. The cost for a one-year supply is $146,645. Four annual renewals are offered at the same annual price, which would total $586,580 if all contract renewals were exercised. The vendor was the low bidder.
And that's Resolution 10E tonight. 6F.
An October 14, 2025 memorandum and proposed resolution from Stephen Pallone, Superintendent of Water Supply and Treatment. Mr. Pallone recommends an agreement with Wind River Environmental LLC, doing business as Franck Environmental of Ivyland, Pennsylvania, to provide screening disposal service at the wastewater treatment plant. Cost for 1 year is $54,922.60. Four annual renewals are offered at the same annual price, which would total $219,690.40 if all contract renewals were to be exercised. Vendor was the low bidder.
Resolution 10F is on the agenda. 6G.
An October 13th, 2025 memorandum, exhibit, and proposed ordinance from Public Works Director Michael Alcall. Mr. Alcall recommends this ordinance and its exhibit describing the legal cartway and right-of-way widths of all city streets affected by Linden Street two-way conversion project and the Broad Street Corridor Improvement Project. The descriptions are necessary to meet a PennDOT requirement.
And ordinance 9A is on the agenda tonight. 6H.
In October 7th, 2025, correspondence from Norris McLaughlin, PA, a law firm representing Cigar Page, Bethlehem, LLC, requesting approval for an intermunicipal transfer of Pennsylvania retail restaurant liquor license number R61034. The applicant seeks approval of an intermunicipal transfer of license which previously issued to Spring Mineral Restaurant and Bar, LLC, for licensed premises located at 702 through 706 Main Street, Northampton Borough, Northampton County, to the new licensed premises located at 1010 Harvard Avenue, Bethlehem, Northampton County.
I'll accept a motion and a second to schedule a public hearing on this proposed intermunicipal liquor license transfer for Wednesday, November 5th, 2025 at 7 p.m. to start our next meeting.
Second.
Motion by Councilwoman Laird, second by Councilwoman Leone. Any discussion? Mr. Miller, call the roll.
Ms. Leone?
Aye.
Ms. Wilhelm?
Aye.
Mr. Callahan?
Aye.
Ms. Jameson Smith?
Aye.
Ms. Kwiatek?
Aye.
Ms. Laird?
Aye.
And Mr. Colon?
Aye. Passed 7-0. So the public hearing is scheduled for Wednesday, November 5th, 2025 at 7 p.m. Then a corresponding resolution will be placed on the November 5 council agenda the same evening. Moving on to reports, there's two things. One, the committee of the whole met earlier tonight to discuss the administration's proposed five-year capital improvement program for years 2026 through 2030. The meeting was for information only. There were no actions or votes taken. The proposed 2026 non-utility capital plan that is incorporated in the five-year capital improvement program will be reviewed by council again during the upcoming budget meetings as part of the proposed 2026 non-utility capital budget. And then I just want to state I won't be at the next city council meeting, so I thank our council vice president Leone in advance for presiding over the first council meeting in November. That's all I have this evening, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Just a couple quick things. One is I did want to provide an update as it related to the sheltered individuals that are living on in the area where Norfolk Southern has their property. We had received the notice letter now, I guess, about 2 months ago. And as we had said at the time, one of the things that we were going to do is going to continue all of our outreach as far as our health bureau is concerned, work with the other nonprofits, be able to gather some information about what people's intentions are and things like that. And, you know, so we have gone out, you know, a couple different times to essentially be able to take account of how many people are living in the area, try to get some information from them. Many of them, we have extensive information because we have ongoing casework with them. We have them connected with different people, you know, in our nonprofit community. But just a couple numbers I wanted to share. In the middle of September, September 16th is when I have the report from. We had a report of 75 people living in the area. When our health bureau went out last week, that number was reduced to 53. So that was a reduction of 22 individuals in the past month or so. 75 was, honestly a bit higher than it had been previously. We think it may be a little bit connected to what was going on in Allentown at the time, as far as people going to a place. And I'm certainly not going to go through and connect everyone's individual story, but we have, and by we, I don't necessarily just mean like our administration, but working with the nonprofits, working with Lehigh Valley Regional Housing Advisory Board, some of these individuals have been able to get long-term housing, which is a real positive. Not everybody has. Other people have left. You don't necessarily know where they are. But as far as like some of those individuals have been very interested, have worked with nonprofits to be able to help establish some permanent housing. Now, obviously, permanent is a difficult word, but it's the intent of long-term living and things like that. In the middle of September, we had tried to gather some information from the individuals. One of the questions we had was, like, what is your interest or your intent, more like was the word we used, to go to BES when the emergency shelter opened? And 55 of the 72 individuals said that they were interested, which we view as a largely a positive number. Now, whether or not some of that 55 also is people down to permanent housing, like, we don't have that level of data, but just that's a number that we were comfortable with. The number that's a little bit more tricky to think about moving forward is that a third of the people, almost 23 out of the 73, said that they had no interest in housing assistance, that they weren't looking to be a part of a program, they didn't want necessary, you know, housing assistance from anybody that we were able to look to offer it to. And I say that not to say that we're not going to keep trying. Like, as we have said, our health bureau and our nonprofits and everybody within this Collins department will continue to work with people a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, whenever it is. It is just that there are some unique challenges with some individuals, and that number is not going to go 53 for 53 as far as permanent housing is concerned. But we are spending a lot of time. We have staff members that go down into the areas multiple times a week between the health bureau and the police department and our connections with the nonprofit community. It is as specific as this person, you know, Jane or Joe, like, oh, that's the person that's got the strong connection with New Bethany, or that's the person that has the strong connection with Lehigh Conference of Churches. So, like, that's the level that we're going on. Now, things obviously could change in the next 2 months. But that's where we are, and we, as with most stories, I'm just being completely honest, it's like there are some success stories, and then there are other people that are a little bit reticent to look for any help, or at least from that is being offered. As I said, it doesn't mean we're not going to stop, but I just wanted to, we haven't necessarily presented a lot of data as far as this is concerned, so I do really want to just say thank you to the Health Bureau and the police, who have very much worked together in being able to gather this very, very important information, this very important data. So as we get, as you know, 2 months from now is when Norfolk Southern had posted. So as we get more information, I will certainly provide it, but I just wanted to kind of give you an update as far as where we are here, right in the middle. You know, if you do have individual stories about individual people, I would just ask you please to talk to us offline, just because we don't want to put people's information out there, but we are more than willing to talk about any individual person if there's somebody that you know that is living in the area. Just a couple other things before we move on here. One is, I do want to give Chief Cott and her staff credit on the 540 Club. They have been working a lot, and they are frustrated to be able to go through this process, but that is something that they've been as responsive as they humanly can be. Chief Cott, Captain Lechman, with both people that live in the immediate area, but also doing all of those things that they need to do as far as the Liquor Control Board. Just a couple other quick things. One is Halloween parades on Sunday at 2 p.m. Hope to see everybody there. We're also at that time where we have a lot of our annual meetings that are coming up, or kind of like annual updates. I know we're pulled in every direction every night of the week, but if you're able to attend, Northside Alive is doing theirs. Their annual meeting on Thursday, November 6th, from 6 to 8 at the YMCA. I think that's where it is, correct, Ms. Collins? It's at the YMCA. So a lot of good news there. Friendship Park's almost done. And then also, if you the next week on Thursday from 5 to 7 over at the Fowler Center, Southside Tomorrow has their annual meeting, which we will be at as well. And they have a lot of good news as well about their neighborhood investment and all the wonderful things that Anna and everybody's doing over there. And just one thing to kind of end on here is just, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, housing struggles, and I'll say something about the tax credits that Mr. Callahan referenced before in a minute, but that tenant advocate that we had helped to fund through Southside Tomorrow, and I think we've shared this number with some of the people, but 70% of the, you know, potential evictions have been able to be prevented by that individual who is working with people. And the work there is truly impressive, because it's not just how do we stop this motion in front of the court on November 1st, but it's a lot of case management about, you know, is, you know, how do we help that stability. Once again, City Council helped to fund that. we have helped to fund it. We provide some staff support to Southside Tomorrow for different things, but Ms. Smith and all of the people there at CADCB are really doing a lot of work. And like I said, we're not going to brag about individual people's stories that they're not being evicted. Like, that's not what we're trying to do here. But we are trying to talk about programs at work. And that is one that we were able to fund, this tenant advocate. And I think it's safe to say that the program, partly because of the dynamic nature of the individual and of the trust that they've been able to build, has been very, very successful in keeping people in their homes. And just to finish then on the other good news, as Mr. Callahan talked about last week, we did once a year, PHFA, which is the Pennsylvania Housing Finance Agency, gives out these tax credits for projects. There were only two in Lehigh Valley. And with the support of the city staff between Ms. Tullo and Ms. Collins, member in their department, LVIP, Penrose, our state delegation, Representative Samuelson, and Senator Boscola, we had a full court press about this, the importance of this project, as far as what it meant for our community and what it meant as far as the type of project that we could get behind. And then they were able to award it, and it's going to mean approximately $60 million in tax credits. And in this round, there were only 41 projects across the state of Pennsylvania, and that includes Philadelphia, and that includes Pittsburgh. So there were only two in the Lehigh Valley, and I think this was the only one in Northampton County. And our first since 2013. So we would all like those projects to be quicker, but that is a big, big deal because it allows us to stay on our timeline as far as being able to start construction. I believe it's next year, with the idea that people would be able to hopefully move in about 2 years, I believe it is, which is what has been what we have been saying from the beginning. But this was a big deal for us, and our ability to be able to complete projects like that just further, like, is able to create the confidence in both the federal government, the state government, and locally. Like I said, it was a real team effort as far as people crossing all the T's, dotting all the I's, and then having, you know, our fellow elected officials, the school district, everybody else get behind it as well, with the kind of full court press about the advantage and the value of this program. But one of the things that was quoted in our application a lot was opening doors and the work that we did as a community to be able to create this. And that was community driven. That was a process that City Council largely supported, and it is something that led us to be able to get this $60 million tax credit to be able to build these units. And I just want to thank all of you for that process, because while we're doing this, I think we're down to four or five citizens here, like, sometimes, like, the work that makes these things happen doesn't necessarily always get attention to it. But this was a real group effort from dozens and dozens of people, and now people are going to be helped at the end of the day, which is always what should be the goal for everybody. I'm not saying that it is, but it should be the goal to help people. So I just want to thank you for that, and that's my report. Thank you, Mr. Corbin.
Thank you, Mayor Reynolds. Moving on, we don't have any ordinances for final passage this evening. So new ordinances, Mr. Miller, 9A.
Ordinance of the City of Bethlehem, Counties of Lehigh and Northampton, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, listing carway and right-of-way width for certain city streets. Bill number 44, 2025, is sponsored by Ms. Wilhelm and Ms. Leon.
Discussion on the ordinance? We'll call the roll.
Ms. Leon?
Aye.
Ms. Wilhelm?
Aye.
Mr. Callahan?
Aye.
Ms. Ramsey Smith?
Aye.
Ms. Kwiatek?
Aye.
Ms. Laird?
Aye.
And Mr. Cologne?
Aye. Passes 7-0. Moving on to resolutions, I'll accept the motion as second to group 10A through 10C together. Those are the three use permit agreements.
So moved.
Second.
Motion by Councilwoman Laird, second by Councilwoman Wilhelm. Any discussion on the motion to group them? Mr. Miller, please call the roll on the motion.
Ms. Leon?
Aye.
Ms. Wilhelm?
Aye.
Mr. Callahan?
Aye.
Ms. Ramsey Smith?
Aye.
Ms. Kwiatek?
Aye.
Ms. Laird?
Aye.
And Mr. Cologne?
Aye. Passed 7-0. Please read resolutions 10A. Through 10C.
Resolution 10A. Be it resolved by the Council of the City of Bethlehem that the Mayor and Controller and or such other city officials as deemed appropriate by the City Solicitor are hereby authorized to execute a use permit agreement with ArtsQuest for the 2025 Chris Kindle Market event. Resolution 10B. Be it resolved by the Council of the City of Bethlehem that the Mayor and Controller and or such other city officials as deemed appropriate by the City Solicitor are hereby authorized to execute a use permit agreement with the Greater Lehigh Valley Chamber of Commerce Foundation for the 2025 Christmas tree lighting ceremony. And Resolution 10C, be it resolved by the Council of the City of Bethlehem that the Mayor and Controller and or such other city officials as deemed appropriate by the City Solicitor are hereby authorized to execute a use permit agreement with the Greater Lehigh Valley Chamber of Commerce for the 2025 Christmas City Village. These resolutions are sponsored by Ms. Wilhelm and Ms. Leon.
Any discussion on use permit agreements? Call the roll.
Ms. Leon?
Aye.
Ms. Wilhelm?
Aye.
Mr. Callahan?
Aye.
Ms. Cramsey Smith?
Aye.
Ms. Kwiatek?
Aye.
Ms. Laird?
Aye.
And Mr. Colum?
Aye. Pass 7-0. 10D.
Be it resolved by the Council of the City of Bethlehem that the Mayor and Controller and or such other city officials as deemed appropriate by the City Solicitor are hereby authorized to execute an agreement with JCI Jones Chemicals Incorporated to provide chlorine to the water treatment plant at wastewater treatment plant. Resolution is sponsored by Ms. Wilhelm and Ms. Leon.
Discussion? Call the roll.
Ms. Leon?
Aye.
Ms. Wilhelm?
Aye.
Mr. Callahan?
Aye.
Ms. Cramsey Smith?
Aye.
Ms. Kwiatek?
Aye.
Ms. Laird?
Aye.
And Mr. Colum?
Aye. Pass 7-0. 10E.
Be it resolved by the Council of the City of Bethlehem that the Mayor and Controller and or such other city officials as deemed appropriate by the City Solicitor are hereby authorized to execute an agreement with Univar Solutions USA LLC to provide sodium hydroxide to the water treatment plant. Resolution is sponsored by Ms. Wilhelm and Ms. Leon.
Discussion? Call the roll.
Ms. Leon?
Aye.
Ms. Wilhelm?
Aye.
Mr. Callahan?
Aye.
Ms. Cramsey Smith?
Aye.
Ms. Kwiatek?
Aye.
Ms. Laird?
Aye.
And Mr. Colum?
Aye. Pass 7-0. 10F.
Be resolved by the Council of the City of Bethlehem that the Mayor and Controller and or such other city officials as deemed appropriate by the City Solicitor are hereby authorized to execute an agreement with Wind River Environmental LLC, doing business as Franck Environmental, to provide screening disposal services at the wastewater treatment plant. Resolution is sponsored by Ms. Wilhelm and Ms. Leon.
Discussion? Call the roll.
Ms. Leon?
Aye.
Ms. Wilhelm?
Aye.
Ms. Callahan?
Aye.
Ms. Cramsey Smith?
Aye.
Ms. Kwiatek?
Aye.
Ms. Laird?
Aye.
And Mr. Colum?
Aye. Pass 7-0. I'll accept the motion as second to consider 10G through 10M as a group for the certificates of appropriateness.
So moved.
Second.
Motion by Councilwoman Wilhelm, second by Councilwoman Leon. Any discussion? Call the roll, Mr. Miller.
Ms. Leon?
Aye.
Ms. Wilhelm?
Aye.
Mr. Callahan?
Aye.
Ms. Cramsey Smith?
Aye.
Ms. Kwiatek?
Aye.
Ms. Laird?
Aye.
And Mr. Colum?
Motion passes 7-0. Please read G through M.
Certificates of appropriateness under the provisions of the Act of the Pennsylvania Legislature, Bethlehem Resolution, are hereby granted for 10G. 46 East Wall Street, to replace an existing picket fence, install a wood arbor, and replant existing landscape beds. 10H. The Bethlehem Historic District Plaque Program, to relaunch the plaque program with a newly designed brass plaque. 10I. 108 through 110 Wesley Street, to remove an existing stair and construct a porch stoop, a sidewalk from the porch to the southwest facing yard, and a sidewalk to the north facing yard. 10J, for 239 East Wall Street, to replace existing roof shingles with GAF Lifetime Timberline HDZ shingles in pewter gray color. 10K, 438 Center Street, to paint trim around the front door and install a classic antique style gas lantern on the front of the house to the left of the entranceway and front door. 10L, 450 Main Street, to install 40-inch by 31.5-inch MDO sign panel for Lovely by Brianna, and 10M, 36 East Wall Street, to install a 12-inch by 14-inch bronze plaque on the front facade to commemorate Joseph H. Traeger and his contributions to the City of Bethlehem. These resolutions are sponsored by Ms. Wilhelm and Ms. Leon.
Any discussion of the group? Call the roll.
Ms. Leon?
Aye.
Ms. Wilhelm?
Aye.
Mr. Callahan?
Aye.
Ms. Cramsey Smith?
Aye.
Ms. Kwiatek?
Aye.
Ms. Laird?
Aye.
And Mr. Colum?
Aye. Pass 7-0. That concludes tonight's agenda. Get home safe, everyone. Stay hydrated.